Well, Flock, I'm so excited to say that Geb Da Silva has agreed to join us for a little extra interview this week. And I loved his interview so much. And it actually sort of put me in a good mood, which, as we all know, is not that easy to do. So thank you for doing that, Kim. And one thing I didn't get a chance to ask you on the interview, we talked a little bit about how you get in and the stories you tell. And I'm just kind of wondering, have you ever been found out? Have you ever been in danger? I mean, you must always be in a little bit of danger, but like serious danger.
On a personal level, we try and mitigate danger, basically. We do little risk assessments. We probably don't do as many as we should be doing. But yeah, when I was talking about being on this monkey trapping gang, etc., on the last day, the last party, we were there and one of the trappers' family said, "We don't believe who you are."
And then, well, they were smart, weren't they?
And exactly. And then we just had to extrapolate that. We had to get out of that situation. You know, we had to basically bluff, and we thought this is going to be a bit tricky. But lucky on that situation, we didn't have hidden cameras or any other thing. So we were able to talk our way out of the situation. And again, these people are, lots of people we kind of investigate aren't most pleasant people. In fact, this monkey trapper said, "If you have any trouble on this island, see me and I'll sort it out for you," for example. You know, these weren't pleasant people. These were, yeah. And
well, it would tend to go with the territory that people who are willing to do this to animals are not going to be the brightest lights.
Exactly. And, you know, there's been other situations where I always get scared that we get caught. And I personally haven't been caught. And there's been a couple occasions out of our 260 projects where our investigators have been caught by the farmers. But we've kind of got a get-out-of-jail card, which is called a press card. All our investigators are members of the International Union of Journalists, and we have a press card. So if we actually do get caught, which has happened twice, we say we're not animal rights activists, we're journalists. And we are covering this for a story. And that kind of changes the dynamic somewhat, really.
Yeah. And it's true, really.
We're not breaking into anything. And so they don't think we're going to do loads of damage there. And then they tend to call the police. And then the police will come and question the investigators and then ultimately let them go, you know. I mean, there was one instance I remember when I was following long-distance animal trucks from the top of the UK all the way down to Italy. And we were following these trucks, and I think the lorry driver finally got a bit annoyed with us regarding Italy after about 25 hours of following him, and called the police. And it was just kind of a scene out of a movie, really. So, you know, you got these flashing lights, the police came round, and the trucks that we're following were veal calves. So these were going to go into crates in Italy. And I just, at the service station, put a hidden camera on around my chest to actually, when we stopped filming, the stop trailing the lorries would actually go into the veal calves. We had a little ruse of how to get in there. But we didn't get there because at this service station, about three or four police cars came with flashing lights, surrounded our car and told us to get out of the car. And we're kind of not used to it in the UK, but, you know, these were Italian policemen with their guns. And this is something we're not used to in the UK. So you're spread eagled. They said, "Get out the car." So you're spread eagled outside the car. And then they do the body check. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I hope they don't feel my hidden camera, which is around the chest type thing. And luckily they didn't, and they were being rude. And we said to them, we're press, and put out the back pocket of our, is our press card. And that kind of literally diffused the situation. We weren't these anarchists. Well, we were anarchists, but we weren't these official stereotypical animal rights activists. We were press getting information. So that's really helped us in a couple of occasions, certainly. That's kind of what we hope to rely on. And there are lots of tricky situations, and yeah, I think.
Are there other countries aside from the US where gag laws or laws like them that are specifically designed to prevent undercover investigations? have interfered with you? Or is that, I know there is some, there was either talk, I'm sure they've been passed in Canada as well, but I don't know whether they have anywhere else.
Not that I'm aware of, basically. There's nothing specifically like ag gag laws. So that's one of the reasons we don't do that much work in the US. It's because...
Well, there are many states that don't have ag gag laws. So don't write us off completely.
But it's also the organizations in the states and some of the, perhaps the radical ones who might not be as radical as you might like to think, who have lawyers that don't allow us to do the work that we'd like to be doing, basically. I'm being quite diplomatic here, is that some organizations... You know, we have contracted deliberations about doing investigations, and then ultimately their lawyers pull the plug on it. And so it's kind of a hasn't got an ag gag law in the States, there's kind of a self-censorship with a lot of American organizations.
Yeah, I would say that there's also the Federal Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And since the animal rights movement became very, very cautious, I think that is shifting now with the work of Direct Action Everywhere, but it became very, very cautious about doing anything that could arguably be considered extra legal.
But that was how I started off back in the 90s, in the late 80s, because when I went on that show with Boy George, for example, talking about investigation and talking about the footage, we denied we'd actually taken the footage. We said, we got this footage donated anonymously, because there was, certainly in the UK there, in the UK at the time, it was very much, if you're an investigator, you're an animal rights terrorist, basically. And so we kind of had that in the late 80s, 90s, that animal rights activists were associated with terrorism. And part of the TV program I made in 93 called Animal Acts was looking into that issue and how they were trying to criminalize animal rights activists through use of conspiracy laws. And there was one great quote of one of the participants in that program, and she said, if the police thought there were three vegans together, they'd think there'd be some sort of criminal activity. And that's how the police thought. That's how people thought back then. Whereas now, if there's three vegans together, they'll be eating their vegan pie.
So what kind of research do you do before you go in? You must have to really pin things down, given how fraught some of these investigations are. How do you find out? Because this is such a secret world.
A lot of it to do with information sources. A lot of it, most investigations, you've just hit the nail on the head, Marianne, because investigations is research, research, research. It's actually planning before you actually get out in the field and attempting to film the material. So a lot of it goes behind the scenes. So that's when I was giving an example on the main section of the program. We luckily got a list of, we're looking into these farms in Europe. I can't say which country. And we've actually just looking on Google Maps. So you're actually mapping places and then you're looking to see where the houses are, what entry points are. Is that good access to actually get some footage? So that's on farm investigations. I mean, other types of investigations we have fake, which I haven't really touched upon, is, we set ourselves up as fake companies. So, for example, we've done a lot on the puppy trade or the puppy mill trade from Eastern Europe to especially the UK and other countries within Europe. And we set ourselves up as fake companies and become puppy dealers, basically. So we'd actually be contacting these puppy mill farms wanting to do business with them. And so that's part of the setup beforehand. You actually set up meetings, and then once you gain access to them, then when you arrive in the country, you can gain access to the footage that you want to kind of get. So it's actually, it's thinking on your feet, but it's also having various hats on or when you're kind of doing these investigations.
It must require a certain level of acting skill.
Often we kind of say we're actors, kind of bad actors, really. Because, investigations are like that. It's really like sitting at a front row of the theatre, really, and watching a bad acting thing. It's
You can't be that bad or you'd be dead.
This is, I'm slightly smiling to myself. It's this one episode, we had two investigators looking into these slaughterhouses in Greece. And they decided, because we have lots of personas, they thought, oh, often we pretend we're from different countries to gain access. And they thought, well, if they were UK, they might be a bit suspicious. So let's pretend we're Australian slaughtermen on holiday in Greece. So they went in there. Because I had to edit all this footage, so this is why, in a way, it cracks me up. And in a way, it's a really tragic situation because you're seeing slaughter. But they're going in there with these really fake Australian accents. G'day, mate. G'day, mate. I can't do it because I'm terrible. I'm a slaughterman from Perth. You know, I just drove by. I just want to kind of see how you do things here. I can't do accents, so that's investigation that I couldn't do.
That's a limitation in your work.
Yeah, no? I'm more the businessman type of actually doing deals. So, you know, I often do on the puppy trade type thing is, yeah, I mean, or in America as the investor in a broiler farm. So it is like acting, yes, you're absolutely right. You know, you're kind of bluffing your way through and it's... Yeah, it's entertaining in a way. Tragic in so many other ways.
Yeah, well, it's good to be able to maintain that perspective because it does seem to be what keeps you going and keeps you doing it. That in spite of, it sounds like not only do you appreciate the results, but except for the fact that it's very harrowing to see what you have to see, you seem to enjoy the work and enjoy the people you work with and feel a lot of fulfillment from it.
I love the team that I work with, and that's part of, you know, working with tracks. You work with good investigators. You know, you wouldn't be coming if you weren't a good investigator. You wouldn't be with tracks, basically. So I have that. That's one beauty of working for a smaller organization, that you can actually choose people who are actually dedicated and good at their jobs. Yeah, there's lots of bits I don't enjoy. I'll be frank. So some of it is when you watch footage for a first time, when somebody has taken some footage. I remember editing animal lab footage last year. And the first time you actually see some footage of various abuses, this was in a Spanish lab, it gets you. It really gets you for 1 or 2 days. And you just, you know, you're in a miserable mood. And then probably about a week, actually, you know, really, this is, you know, you watch it and then they don't really take it in. But then you kind of get professional about it. You've got to make this, you know, there's no point in that footage just staying on my computer or in the old days on the cutting room floor. You've actually got to make it into a watchable piece of content, which is going to change either the public opinion or is it going to change legislative opinion? So, you know, you kind of get into professional bits. So I wouldn't say it's all fun and games.
No, I didn't mean to imply. But I think most people hearing about it would just think that would be the most horrible work on the face of the earth. And yet, even though possibly it is, you also seem to just find a lot of positives in it with the people you work with and the results that you're able to create.
I think that's the key. It goes back to when I said earlier, these images aren't mine to keep. These are the images to get out in the world. These are images to create change. And the fact that I've known that as a result of our footage, we have created legislative change. You know, we have stopped exports from certain countries going to other exports. We have saved individual animals. We did an investigation in France where we documented the conditions of 3 bears, big brown bears that were in for the entertainment business, that were kept in horrific conditions that they had been for the last 10 to 15 years. And within 3 months of our investigations, those animals were released into sanctuaries. And again, last year, we had a similar thing of like 10 tigers, which had been kept in the entertainment industry for circuses. And to know they've been released into sanctuary as a direct result of our investigation. You know, you don't often get these quick hits, and when that happens you think, wow, this is rewarding. You know, this actually makes it worth the pain, worth the torment, etc.
Do you temper your videos? Well, you have two different audiences that you make videos with. I mean, as you mentioned, you make some for the public and some for specifically for legislative purposes. I know for making videos for the public, there's sometimes a worry that it's too horrible and people will just shut down and you have to like somehow time it or do something else to make it so that people will watch it. Do you worry a lot about that?
Well, I'm just going back to the example of the Spanish lab that we did last year, made a video for. And over 1 million people have watched it on YouTube. And that's the Spanish version as opposed to the UK version. So when you're making the videos, you have to balance the total goal. Sometimes, you know, and I just can't look at it. So, you know, you don't go out for total goal. You go to try and make an emotive video because, you know, you make propaganda. I make no bones about that. You know, I'm not an objective filmmaker. I want to change the world. So, yeah, you do temper the footage. But, I mean, a lot of our footage now, we kind of literally just create the material or the content and then we give to other organizations to actually temper it to their specific audiences. And because we used to do a lot of videos for ourselves, but now because we're doing so many projects and videos take so much time, we kind of limit that and literally just gather the content, gather the material. And that's one thing I don't, you know, because I haven't got a clue with social media. You know, I couldn't get 1 million hits on anything, somebody to watch 1 million hits. You know, we have at Trax, you know, I literally run our Twitter and Instagram account, but I've got no clue what I'm doing. And that's not what Trax is about, really. We're not really about promoting ourselves as such, even though it's something I feel I ought to do. But, you know.
No, I think you should. The work you're doing is so special and so incredibly important that I think that you should stick to what you're good at, because you seem to be very good at it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and that's true, because getting into the world of social media is it's another world which I'm, you know, I'm old. I was going to say, if I was born, you know, I'm not used to that world. You know, I don't personally engage with it on that basis, but I totally get the reason why people use it as a platform, but on a personal level, it's not something I'm engaged with. Whereas podcasts, I do love, absolutely, because I love the fact that you can actually engage with it in a different way. So I'd actually much rather listen to people talk about things as opposed to just put a like on an Instagram like, because you have to engage with the podcast. You know, you actually commit to actually listening to it. And
I hear you.
Of course you do.
I do. And especially like Instagram, I'm just like, I keep trying to make myself go on Instagram and try to get it. And try, and you're at least a visual person. I'm not even a particularly visual person. And then it's just a bunch of pictures. Like I don't understand it, but don't tell anybody because it makes me very
old. I'm with you on that. And I mean, the other project, which I'm just about to embark on, if we've got some time to talk about, is I'm doing a sound project. So I've kind of been working in the visual world for the last 35 years. And it's part of the reaction to what we're talking about, these likes on Instagram. I just thought, how do you get an other audience for animal advocacy work and for investigations? So I've been lucky enough to get a grant from Lush to make a CD, because I like physical, a product of animal sounds, basically, and how humans interact, our complex relationship with animals, and how we use it for food, fashion, entertainment, etc. And so that would be using clips from investigations that I've used in the past of, for example, farmers talking about aspects or perhaps even the industrial sounds of when we were in China, of just hearing on a chicken processing plant, it's actually hearing that repetitive sound of machinery, etc., and trying to evoke an emotion, and trying to invoke a picture or invoke a sensation in the audience. So it's something new for me, and it's quite experimental.
Yeah, that sounds extraordinary. Yeah, I can't wait.
So yes, that's a new avenue which I will be doing this year. It's something
That is a totally new way of trying to communicate this. And
you know, it's not my bread and butter work, but it's something I'm always looking to ways to get involved with promoting animal advocacy. And, you know, filmmaking was the obvious one back in the 80s. And perhaps sound is the way, and is the way. And it's part of the rise of the podcast. You know, it's, I'm really into listening to things, and I think people want to hear things. So I think there's lots of avenues, potential avenues for that little project.
Well, it sounds exciting. And I'm so glad that you have decided to come in from the cold and start talking to podcasts, and that we got to be one of them, because you should be talking more. I mean, not only is your work completely fascinating, but you're such a good communicator. So I really appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much, Kim.
That's fabulous. As I said, I'm not a numbers and figures person. I've kind of always thought people want to know facts and figures. But yeah, I'm kind of realizing story kind of important too.
People want stories. I have always said that if we were going to have a name for our species, it would be the storytelling ape. That's what we are. We tell stories.
No, that's perfect. Yes.
Thanks so much. It's a joy.
Okay. Thank you, Marianne.